Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Roderick Campbell. He's a CEO and founder of Commit Change, an online fundraising company, and a co-founder of the Houdini Project, which helps activists throughout the world to access resources from international supporters. He works with hundreds of organizations throughout the world to build stronger societies. So first off, thank you for your work. Second, thank you for being on the program.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
So what is the Houdini Project, and why is it important to significant social change?
The Houdini Project was the byproduct of sort of our background in Silicon Valley, which is, I don't say that proudly, but we sort of were birthed out of that world and worked in it for about 6 years, specifically in fundraising and specifically in the United States, and as sort of one of these like social impact startups. And we realized that that wasn't really enough pretty quickly. And what was missing from that was you can't have sort of all of this intellectual property and all of this technology wrapped up in a single company and hope to do well in the world, to actually impact the world in any sort of meaningful, scalable way. So the Houdini Project is the open source version of everything that we've built over the last 6 or 7 years. So this big chunk of technology that relates to fundraising and organizing. And what that means, open source, just to back that up a little bit, is open source means that the technology is freely available to anybody in the world. So anybody in the world can copy that technology, they can modify the technology, they can run it themselves to do just about anything. The only stipulation being, with our specific license, is it's called the AGPL license, which is a copyleft license. So anybody who uses the technology also has to make all of the modifications that they make to the technology or any additions also publicly available under the same license. So it's this share and share alike sort of motive. So the Houdini Project is a whole bunch of fundraising infrastructure that whose objective is to help organizations and groups of people throughout the world raise funds for the causes that they're working on and effectively be able to organize, but most importantly, to be able to do those things, fundraise and organize, with a very high degree of security. So with the ability to host and maintain all of their own data from anywhere in the world, whether it's off of a computer in their own house, off of something public or more public like Amazon web servers, or off of some super, super secure server, say somewhere in Europe where they have protection under GDPR. So the goal is for people to be able to organize. Sort of our mission statement when we started this project was you can imagine that there are some states in the world, I won't name specifics, but there are some places in the world that are becoming increasingly restrictive. And those sort of oppressive environments can be very dangerous for organizers, and especially organizers who need a high degree of security. And it can also have a chilling effect on people who want to be able to donate or send resources to those groups or to those causes. So what the Houdini Project has set out to do is to allow somebody who lives in, say, a very repressive state, to be able to organize for, say, human rights-related activities or environmental-related activities that may be under a great deal of scrutiny with enough security that they can do that securely, both on the side of organizing their supporters and also on the side of being able to receive funds internationally with some degree of privacy or anonymity.
Well, I'm gonna follow your lead and not name countries. I'm not sure why we would or wouldn't, but I'm just going to follow your lead. And so let's pretend to choose a great, easy example that one is attempting to organize in Nazi Germany, and we'll bring that we'll bring that historical situation up to modern technology. Mm-hmm. So, can you please be explicit about the differences between somebody in Nazi Germany is going to, I mean, give me this. If I start this off, can you move the scenario forward for me?
Yeah, unless we can be a little bit more explicit. Okay. Let's use a concrete example. Let's say that you're a human rights organizer in either Russia or in Turkey. Okay. So you're working on like LGBTQ rights in Russia, or you're working on some essential human rights in Turkey. Those are countries that have a lot of control over their internet infrastructure. And have a great deal of force that they can exert on the outside world on companies like Amazon or on Google. And it becomes very easy for them to sort of grab your data. to identify. So for instance, if you have a list of all of your organizers or of people who have supported your organization, there are very few places right now that you can store that data securely and be able to access it and retrieve it without sort of getting caught in the middle. It's also very, very difficult when you're in one of those countries to receive funds. So if I wanted to, say, donate to a human rights organization or an LGBTQ organization in Russia, one of the biggest problems is that in, like, Russia, that organization is not most of the time going to be able to access a bank account, let alone receive international transactions. So they're shut off from international support. The same could be true and is true of organizers, say, in the Amazon. So there are a couple of solutions to these things. To the privacy-related problem, the biggest thing is your big weakness is when you're storing data on a another website that you can't control. So say you go to just a generic fundraising website. I don't know, GoFundMe or Kickstarter.
Right. Yep.
And you have your supporters donate through there. The biggest weakness there is that it doesn't take very much pressure to get GoFundMe or to get Kickstarter or any website like that to hand over the donor data for everybody who has supported an organization. And then you effectively have a blacklist of people. Some of them may be within the same country as the organizer, some of them may be outside the country, but that has certainly a chilling effect that prevents people, or doesn't necessarily prevent them, but slows them down in their support of a lot of organizations. That's one big weakness. The other big weakness is to effectively organize at scale. It's essential that you be able to have a large database of all of your supporters, or at least the supporters who are willing to provide data. But then that presents, obviously, a hugely risky scenario where if you can't securely store that data, you've effectively put together a list of people for an oppressive regime. And that's sort of like the one of the big struggles among a lot of organizers that I've worked with, particularly in Europe, where internet-related privacy is a big debate right now. So,
go ahead, please.
So what this allows people to do then is, rather than hosting that data with a third party, for the very first time, they're able to host that data entirely on their own their own security standards, but without losing sort of the features and the tools that they would get if they were using, you know, a competitive private service.
Okay, and I'm sorry if this is a really ignorant question, because I just
it's okay.
I don't know computers that well, but mm-hmm. So someone is organizing against a proposed dam or mine in the Amazon basin.
Sure.
And they're going to fundraise through Kickstarter or whatever, or they're going to fundraise through the Houdini Project. And I understand the part about how other services might capitulate if a government entity or a corporate entity puts pressure on them, especially a government entity, puts pressure on them to reveal who donated. I understand that part. But then where I got a little bit confused was, like, the list of support or the organizing. Let's back up a second. Just walk me through. So I want to stop a dam. I live in the Amazon basin, and I want to stop a dam or a mining project, a proposed one. And I what do? I write to you. I say, hey, Roderick, can you help me? I don't understand what actually happens.
Sure. I mean, somebody in that situation, they certainly could, and I can connect them with people. I mean, the number of requests that we receive for that sort of thing outstrips our ability to support everybody. However, we do have a large network of computer programmers who are sympathetic to those sorts of causes, and often what we do is connect them. So the first thing that would be necessary is if you had a movement of any sort, and that movement really needed to be able to have their data be very secure, and they also needed to be able to receive international support without the restrictions of, say, banks shutting them down. They would potentially reach out to us if they were not very tech savvy, and we would help explain it to them, and then we would potentially help connect them to engineers or help answer the questions of an engineer that they can identify depending on their security needs. And walk them through the process of setting this up. It's sort of like WordPress, if you're familiar with that. where it used to be back in the day, it was very difficult to set up a website. You sort of had to build it from scratch every time, or the options that were out there were very, very difficult. But WordPress made it very easy to launch a website very quickly. The Houdini project is exactly the same thing when it comes to fundraising and organizing that infrastructure, except it's just like WordPress, it's entirely self-hosted. So if you've got that group, say in the Amazon, organizing against a dam, and they need a very high degree of security, and they need to be able to receive international support outside of the banks, then that organization would need to identify a computer programmer or somebody who is reasonably tech savvy. And then that person would take the Houdini project and put it on their own secure server. And there are a whole bunch of ways, without going down a rabbit hole of server security, there are a number of ways to set up a very secure server where that would host all of their data. So they would have full control over their data instead of some third-party company controlling their data. An example of that would be they could have supporters in a Scandinavian country or in a place like Germany potentially that you know is hosting the data for them through a trusted person, or they could go to some extreme, you know, hosting potentially that data on a highly encrypted server in a – these actually exist in like a bunker site. So there's a whole range of security available. We would help them connect, help answer their questions. We never touch the data ourselves as the team because we have to remain neutral. We don't want to get that closely involved, but we can guide them through the process. And then as far as the transactions, the way that we get around, and this is sort of a double-edged sword, but the way that we get around banks in terms of being able to guarantee that you can get funds to somebody is we're currently working on cryptocurrency integrations. So we're building cryptocurrency into it. And I have very mixed feelings about cryptocurrency. In fact, I have very mixed feelings about most technology. But which is I know I understand the irony. But
no, it's not ironic. I mean, for crying out loud, I use publishing. I mean, we are engaged in, we can call it a struggle, we can call it a war, we can call it whatever we want, and it always. There's a friend of mine always says the task of an activist is not to navigate oppressive systems of authority with as much personal integrity as possible. The task of an activist is to confront and take down those systems of oppressive authority. So I don't care about personal purity at all. I mean, the point is to stop the dam. And if right. I mean, it's ridiculous to think that when the other side has tanks, guns, airplanes, concrete, the full power of the state behind it, that we're supposed to do this by, I don't know, rubbing sticks together. I mean, we use whatever tools, you know, we use lawsuits when necessary, we use cryptocurrency when necessary, we use whatever tools are necessary.
Absolutely.
So I don't actually have that mix. Being a member of shall we say an older generation than you, you know, I actually know my way a little bit around cryptocurrency, but still the word scares me.
For sure.
I mean, I'm not even talking on a political level. It just is like, as soon as somebody says server, my brain starts shutting down.
Hey, fair enough. We all bring our own skills to the table. But for instance, cryptocurrency I think is our best friend. It is the way that we circumnavigate the control of banks on resources.
Can you give a 1 minute primer on cryptocurrency for those who? Well, I want to give if I may, I want to give a little bit of a backstory, just because.
Please.
It's the reason I heard about cryptocurrency in the first place is just because one of the great things about being a writer is that. Or I guess not being a writer, but it was I fit as a writer because I get these wild hairs. And one night late, I just got this, and I don't even do drugs, but I was like, hey, I wonder if there's such a thing as an online drug market. Uh-huh. And this is like 5 or 6 years ago, or however long ago. And so I just typed in that to Google, and and I heard about Silk Road, which just it blew me away that there was such a thing. And again. Mm. I have never in my life used any illegal drug. So I was like, this is just, I don't even drink caffeine for that matter. But it still just struck me as incredibly fascinating that this thing exists. So then, of course, if I hear about Silk Road, then the next thing I hear about is I have to know, understand a little bit about Bitcoin. And so that's the only reason I know about any of that stuff, is I started down that just exploring that a little bit. So so I know that Bitcoin is this weird thing on the computer that doesn't actually exist, but it ends up being worth a lot of money. So can you give a better definition of a cryptocurrency than that?
I hope. Sure. So cryptocurrency, when you think about a currency, there's a few things that you need. You need something that has a predictable value or a reasonably predictable value. You need a process that allows you to, with a very, very, very high degree of certainty, ensure the transactions each way. So people sending money, people receiving money, receive and are able to send that accurately. And in service of that, you need a public ledger. So you need to be able to prove which transactions or, you know, that a transaction worked or did not work and where the money moved. So it's those are sort of the most basic components of any functional currency.
And I want to give an example of that. That 10 years ago, I bought something and they lost my check. And then they asked me to send them another check. So I did. Mm-hmm. And then 10 years go by, and then they forgot that I sent them the second check, and they found the first check again and said, hey, can you send us that money again? And I'm like, I don't even remember what's going on. So I went to my bank, and the bank showed that my second check had actually gone through. I sent them a copy of that, and they said, oh, we're so sorry. We screwed up. It's all good. So that's what I'm just giving that as an example of the ledger.
Exactly.
And why the ledger is important.
Yep, it's essential. I mean, that's a perfect example. So you need these components. You need sort of the infrastructure for the transactions. You need the absolutely verifiable ledger, and you need something that has at least a somewhat predictable value. So cryptocurrencies, the most popular of them is Bitcoin, and it's just sort of the one that has taken off the most. There are actually at this point probably 10,000 different cryptocurrencies. But Bitcoin is the one most people talk about. And the beauty of Bitcoin is that, or any cryptocurrency, is that you can make a transaction in San Francisco or New York or anywhere to, say, Abu Dhabi or to the middle of the Amazon rainforest, anywhere where somebody has an internet connection. And it will happen instantaneously, and it cannot be controlled by any government, and it cannot be controlled by any other third-party institution. It exists, the infrastructure for that exists autonomously and independently of any institution or group. So you can see the beauty in that. It means that all of a sudden, if you have a group that's organizing in the Amazon, and the government that they're living under, has made it relatively oppressive, or even the banking institutions have made it difficult to open a bank account. For most of those organizations, it becomes very, very, very difficult, if not impossible, to receive, say, credit card transactions or even cash transactions if people want to send money. And if they are able to, there are great massive fees involved, and often there are long time delays involved. So with cryptocurrency, like Bitcoin, you can make the transaction instantaneously, and the funds hit their what's called a Bitcoin wallet instantaneously. The only difficulty in this whole process is that if you receive Bitcoin, you have to be able to trade it for something. So you have to be able to trade it either for a local currency, or you have to be able to trade it for a service or a need that you have specifically. The beauty of Bitcoin versus other cryptocurrencies is that it's become everyone. Almost everybody at this point is familiar with Bitcoin, at least vaguely, and there is actually quite a large economy, even outside of the black market economy, for people who accept Bitcoin right now.
I've seen Bitcoin kiosks at malls.
Yeah, it's a bizarre phenomenon. but it's becoming accessible suddenly. So for an activist who's in that situation, I think that the value of being able to relatively anonymously and instantaneously receive financial support from anyone in the world without the control or oversight of banks or government institutions can be quite valuable.
So this group in the Amazon has set up their Well, what have they actually set up? They've set up their own server. They've set up the Houdini software on their server. Is this? I'm sorry again for being so ignorant about computers.
No, you're fine. You're fine. Yeah. So there are two ways they can go about taking advantage of this. The easiest, if an organization just needs to receive funding, They don't need to do any sort of organizing, and this is, you know, a small scale sort of operation. Then it's really, really easy. You just create a Bitcoin wallet and just Google that. Like, how do I create a Bitcoin wallet? It only takes a few minutes, and then you can immediately begin to receive Bitcoin. It's really, really simple. But then larger organizations or groups of people, the other dilemma, the second part of this, is the organizing component. So when you're organizing, you know, more than a dozen people, it becomes really valuable to be able to keep a database of those people, where you have all of their contact information, where you have a list of their skills and capacities, where you're able to organize them into specific groups. A good example of this would be military organizations, for instance. Part of the structure of a successful military is that you need to be able to have a roster of everybody who's in your military. You need to be able to contact those people, and you need to be able to assign their skills, and you need to be able to assign them to various groups or capacities, and you need to be able to keep track of that in a very highly secure way, because you don't want that information sort of leaking out to the public. So that would be the most kind of clear example of what you need a larger system for, is the side where you begin to organize people, both supporters and, you know, people on the ground, at any scale, you know, above, say, 10 people. So that's the infrastructure that we provide on the back end. It's not just the ability to receive the transactions and to facilitate the fundraising side of things, but also a very large system for organizing, you know, potentially, I mean, some people are organizing 100, 150,000 people using the system. And the reason that we split it off into the Houdini project is so that people can do that, but have absolute full control over their data. So they have all of the capacity to organize with these sophisticated tools, but with extreme privacy.
So can you give, you just said, I don't remember, did you say 150,000? You said a lot of people. Can you give some examples of organizations that are using this, and obviously don't, you know, don't mention the ones that are
right.
super secret. But,
well, and I don't even know any of those.
Interesting.
It's publicly available. Like, we don't need to know who you are for you to use our software. That's an essential component. But yes, there's one very above ground organization, as an example, that's public about it and would not mind me talking about it. In Europe, there's a very large progressive organizing group called WeMove.eu. They're the sister organization of MoveOn.org. And they're quite large. They operate throughout the entirety of the EU. And they were one of our first partners on this project, and they've been using the Houdini project, I think, for now for somewhere between 6 months and a year. And they're one of the bigger contributors to the project as a whole. So they use us for all of their core fundraising. So the financial support that goes into their organization, and then they are also using the back-end system in order to kind of group those supporters together, send them fundraiser messages, you know, group together their skill sets and do things like that.
And so this small group in the Amazon that mm-hmm. that uses this, it's do they pay you? How does that work?
No, absolutely not. All of our technology is freely available to anyone in the world. They can, if you were, you know, even a beginner software programmer, you could go to the Houdini project and download the entire code base and spin it up on your own server, you know, probably within a day, and it's yours. You own it. We never even have to talk to you. It's just freely available.
Sorry to get mercenary here, but so how do you pay the rent? I mean, this all takes money.
Of course it does. So we, let's see, about 7 years ago, I started a tech company, a startup, and did the sort of tech startup crap. And one of the difficulties is in building this sort of technology, it's not cheap. And it's not really something that you can just sort of like do on your own, because it would take you a decade. So what we ended up doing was I heard about Silicon Valley. I was at the time in a place called Olympia, Washington. I just graduated from the Evergreen State College. We sort of had this idea about this fundraising infrastructure and the impact that it could have on the world, but we needed to get it funded. So myself and my co-founder, we looked up all of these different what are called accelerator programs in Silicon Valley, where they'll take, you know, quote, promising sort of like tech startup founders and give them money for their venture. And we put together, I put together a list of them, and I identified the main investors or decision makers for each of them. My background's in sociology. So convenient hack, anyone is welcome to steal this one. I put together a demographic and a psychographic profile for each of them. So their demographic data and their psychological sort of like profile. And so things that they're like, or things that they're interested in, people who they're connected to, all based on publicly available data. And then what I did was I put together Facebook ads very cheaply, because they were super cheap at the time. And I just slammed those people, like targeted it down to them and 10 people, and then just slammed them with advertisements. And that was enough to get their attention. That got us into our accelerator program, our first one. And we ended up using sort of similar tactics to raise just over $1 million in venture capital. That was about what it took to build all of this. So it's about a $1.2 million I think we've invested so far in this project. What we've done since then is we ended up building a company that's indefinitely self-sustaining. We have customers who need us because they don't have the tech capacity, mostly nonprofit organizations. They don't have the tech capacity to run this sort of system themselves. So they pay just a flat fee, a percentage of each transaction that goes through the nonprofit organization. And then probably 80% of those proceeds go towards our software development. And all of the software that we develop is then open source under the Houdini Project. So we sort of, in a way, in a soft sort of way, we sort of you know, got through Silicon Valley, made it through the 98% fail rate, got a company that was sustaining itself financially, and then sort of went rogue with our software and made it open source, which, to my knowledge, is the first time that's ever happened.
So this is all great. And I don't mean for this to sound too much like an infomercial, but I'm on your page that has the features for the project.
Yep.
And it's, or for the Houdini software or whatever it is. And, you know, again, I'm just sort of sitting here aghast, because it's all the different stuff that all this can do. It seems like it would actually be really, really helpful for, I mean, again, I don't mean to be too much of a fan here, but I'm gonna really recommend that DGR start using this. It looks like it just has the capacity to do all sorts of things that frankly just all make my brain shut down immediately, you know. Whether it's the bulk emailing, bank level security, just all sorts of different, excuse my language, crap. Just all sorts of really stuff that could be actually very important. And go ahead, please.
I hope so. Like, this is, I mean, this is what we have to contribute. I think the realization is, you know, we're all on this tiny little ball of dirt and water careening through a lot of dark void. And it's, all of us are at risk right now. And I don't mean like all of us as in all humans. I mean all of us. And I think that making this freely available to people and then helping facilitate them, you know, use it to its maximum capacity, is, if that's the way that we can contribute, then that's how we'll show up. And that's just the end of it. That's why we don't want there to be any sort of like money involved. Or, I mean, our tech is everyone else's tech. And now that I don't own it anymore, now that it's public, I think it can have a profound impact on the world.
Hold that thought about profound impact, because I want to come back and ask you what you think that impact is. But before then, I want to sort of step back and say something that I hammer a lot, which is, you know, I interviewed Sherry Tippy, who is one of the world's experts at relocating beavers, and the reason she started doing that is because when there was a beaver somewhere, there was somebody who was going to put a mall, they would kill it, and that bothered her. And instead of just complaining about it, she learned how to become a live trapper and put them where people want them, and where the beavers are happy and not dead. And my friend Deanna Meyer, used to drive past this place where there was a big prairie dog village, and they were going to put in a mall, and instead of just complaining about it, or in addition to complaining about it, like we all do, she started doing something about it. She's doing a great job of fighting for prairie dogs. And the reason I write the stuff I do is partly because in my 30s, I mean, I also wanted to be a writer, but in addition, I realized that there was a big hole in discourse. And my mom taught me when I was really young that if you see a problem, don't complain about it, just fix it. And so you are, or Darja Mayo, one more example. Darja Mayo, yeah. Just a normal guy out of Alaska who didn't like the way the media was covering the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And so instead of just complaining about it like we all do, he went over and did a better job. And so I just, this is a long way of thanking you for your work, because there is, you know, instead of just going, God, here's a problem, I don't know what to do, God, isn't this terrible, you fixed it. And that makes you one of my heroes. So thank you for that.
Thanks. Dar was an astute name to call up. He actually, I've been following Dar since his coverage of the Iraq War, and particularly his coverage of Fallujah, and would call him both a hero and a friend. Like it's very much. Thank you, Dar. If you hear this, you're very much part of the reason that we decided to kind of do the extreme thing.
So you know, a friend of mine always says that the big distinction is not between those who want to bring it all down and those who don't, or those who believe, you know, none of those distinctions on tactics are the real one. The big distinction is between those who do something and those who do nothing. Mm. And so again, I just have so much respect for someone who sees a problem and sets out to try to fix it. So A, do you want to say anything about that? And then B, after that, let's talk about your hope for the effect of this on the world.
I think so for the people who are listening, one of the key groups that we need on side that I see missing are computer programmers. I see them sort of conspicuously missing from the movement, and there are a few, but they're too rare. And the amount of impact that they can have is pretty significant, especially in the very beginning, the first sort of like, you know, potentially, I would imagine, the first 20 years of sort of the struggle. So if there are any of you listening to this, or if you know any, please share it with them, because I think that we need that representation, and it's all too easy to be comfortable sort of sitting at your computer typing away on something that, you know, may or may not be, but likely is frivolous, you know, making a very healthy salary. But I would encourage those people not to kind of get stuck in that delusion for too long. And those are the people, like, if we could pull together, you know, 10 very dedicated people sort of doing this stuff like what we've been doing at the Houdini Project, we've already got 3. If we could pull in another 7, the amount of impact that we could have on the world is really profound. And I think that transitions there into kind of talking about the hope for impact. So do you want me to just talk about that generically, or do you have more of a specific angle?
Well, actually, before then, I want to ask you one more thing about I'm really interested in the process of how you went, or how anybody goes from thinking, gosh, here's a problem, to actually, what was it that that pushed you? You know, it's like, what was it that pushed Dar from going, God, the coverage stinks, to actually getting on a plane and going over there? So what was it that pushed you from going, God, here's a problem, to going, hey, I think I can do something about this?
It was the awareness of self-reinforcing feedback loops, these feedback systems, and how rapidly and terrifyingly they can kick into play.
You're talking about global warming?
Yeah, I don't really. Yeah, climate change, climate disruption, ecosystem death. I mean, things like the ice albedo effect, ocean acidification, permafrost, methane clathrate. I mean, those systems. The realization that the planet and the ecosystem that has maintained life since the beginning of life on this planet we've always sort of, or I have most of my life always assumed that these are really robust systems that we really can't profoundly affect. We could annihilate ourselves, but we can't annihilate life. And for me, and I'm not sure, I don't know if this is true, but this is my perspective, is that those systems, or that my perspective change, is that those systems are not these robust, invulnerable systems.
Yep.
That in fact, they are precariously balanced. And that it's within our grasp to not only annihilate ourselves, which is, of course, in some ways horrifying, but that we can annihilate life as a whole on the planet, which is such a rare, beautiful thing. It was the realization of how precarious it was that it struck me to action.
Well, thank you so much for that. And thank you. I mean, I have been screaming for decades now that it is really time for all hands on deck. And so, you know, that's one reason I am so excited that you are on deck in a capacity that, see, this is the thing that's so clear too, is that social movement, you know, 98% or 90-some% of the military never fires their weapon in combat. You know, there is a need for everyone. And in you know, you mentioned programmers, and one of the most important people in Deep Green Resistance is Norris Tomlinson, who is just a fantastic computer person who makes everything work.
Yep.
And at the same time, we also need tax accountants. You know, we also need people who are organized, which is not me. We need people who are extroverts, which is not me. You know, we need everything, including those programmers. So now that we've sort of hammered this to death, can we move on to your specific hopes for this project and how it can help to move us away from the murder of the planet?
Yeah. And I'll start with my big fear about this tech. The tech that we're releasing, of course, that we have released, it has the potential for great good, and it also has the potential for kind of horrific evil in the world. That now that it's released, a lot of that is outside of our control. The only thing that remains in our control is sort of who we tell first and who we personally decide to sort of like cultivate along the way. But it's out there. And the risk, of course, of the great sort of evil of something like this is the ability to organize, you know, with a high degree of anonymity and security, and the ability to receive funding from anywhere in the world with a fairly high degree of anonymity. Those two things in combination can power some things that I think are absolutely abhorrent. So, for instance, you know, terror cells in very conservative sort of alt-right terror cells. So that's the fear, is that we don't sort of like get the technology into the right hands and the knowledge into the right hands quickly enough that side gains the advantage. The hope is that we will be able to get the word out about what this technology can do and how to use it to people who are more on side with life and some degree of, I don't know, a future that includes some sort of some beauty in it, right? So the hope then is that we will have a few larger organizations like Commit Change, which is the private company that we started, and WeMove.eu, which is the progressive organizing group in Europe. Groups like that, that are larger and have resources, will adopt the technology, just like we have, and will contribute to it. So in other words, not financially necessarily, but will contribute technology and ongoing code and maintenance, like we have been, because more hands means lighter work. And if we can get those larger organizations to adopt this technology, then the technology will, of course, innovate and grow rapidly, much faster than we've been able to single-handedly make it grow and innovate. And the beauty of the licensing structure that we put together means that technology then will be, even as it grows and becomes more and more sophisticated and more easy to use and does more interesting things, that innovation and technology won't be locked up behind a private company. It will also be available to the smallest organizing group in the Amazon that has only a tenuous connection to the internet, and, you know, say a friend in Scandinavia who they trust willing to, like, host their data, and that organization on the ground fighting a dam will be able to receive funding from all over the world, from people anonymously, to do with whatever they feel is necessary for their situation, and that they will also have the resources and the capacity to communicate with their supporters securely and to be able to organize and mobilize the supporters at whatever scale is necessary for whatever their objective is. And the hope is that that it is the people who gain the first mover advantage will be people who are fighting for life and fighting for some degree of equity in the world, not just human equity, but equity among life. And some degree of sustainability. And that's why I hope that some of the people, maybe one or two of the people out there listening, you know, will hear this message, understand that this exists. If need be, anonymously contact us, and we'll answer technical questions without having to know who you are, and that will give us, you know, a little bit of an advantage. That's the whole hope.
Yeah, that's really great. I'm thinking about the sort of, you know, terrorist angle a little bit, and you know, it's kind of one reason that I was thinking about this before. It was one reason I sort of brought the Silk Road thing, which is certainly not the same thing as a terrorist, but that you know, anything that's created is going to be used for all sorts of purposes, and this is a, you know. I mean, the thing I think about all the time is, do you remember the movie Wall Street, Oliver Stone? And that's the one with Gordon Gekko, is played by Michael Douglas, and mm-hmm. he has that line about greed is good.
Uh-huh.
And he was a villain, and Oliver Stone wrote him as a villain, and a lot of people in Wall Street then took on his statement as being a statement of good. I mean, as a positive thing, when it was actually, you know, this evil person saying greed is good, and I'm presuming Oliver Stone was hoping everybody would go, yeah, he's a nasty person saying a nasty thing, so we all understand that's nasty.
Uh-huh.
And I guess I'm just I shouldn't be asking you this question, but I'm going to anyway, which is, this is something that happens all the time, is if we create something good, it's still, you know, we throw it out into the world, and then within a few years, somebody's using it for something nasty, and that's no reason not to create it. It's just I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just growling in frustration at this. I mean, for crying out loud, you know, you have, let's pretend for a second that Jesus was real, and you have this guy walking around talking about love your neighbors yourself, and within 200 years they're killing each other in his name.
Yeah.
So I don't.
Yeah.
So I understand your concern. Well, actually, I have another concern, another question then. So if it can be used for that, and mm-hmm. both you and I don't want it to be used for that, and we're not winking, we're saying no, hell no, that's very bad.
Yeah.
Can you get in trouble if this is used by somebody horrible?
It's a great question. I mean, we've thought about this, obviously. The angle that we're taking on it is that it's no different than if we had invented WordPress, which allows you to build a website. Anybody in the world can build a website that has any content on it that they want. And of course, some horrible organizations use WordPress. And because the code is publicly accessible, there's not very much that WordPress can do about it. That's just the nature of making the code public. So that's sort of the angle. And I don't know. I mean, in terms of legal repercussions, I don't think particularly. I'm not really worried about that. Although, given the state of the United States, who knows where that could go or what the repercussions could be, you know, whether or not it's just. But there's a good reason. I mean, that's partially why we've relocated to Europe rather than the United States, is to get that a little bit of distance. I don't know. The truth is, I don't know what the outcome is going to be. I'm not particularly worried about legal repercussions, but doing something like this obviously puts you on radars that aren't necessarily radars you want to be on.
And I hate it when people give me advice, but I'm going to give you advice. and I'm going to tell you what to feel, and I hate it when people tell me what to feel, but I'm going to do it to you anyway, which is that if anybody ever does use it for bad, don't feel bad, because that won't be your fault. You know, you've created something good, and there's going to be, you know, people can use a fork to kill somebody, you know? It's like somebody somewhere is going to, you know, there was a guy went into a television station and shot some people. This was 10 years ago or something. And I believe he was saying something about the book Ishmael, Daniel Quinn's work, before he went in. It's like, that's not Daniel Quinn's fault. The guy's just nuts.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm at the point where I think that the good, after thinking about this, it took us 2 years to open source this before we finally released it. So there was a lot of time to think about it. And for me, the cost of not releasing it is greater than the cost of releasing it, because right now we, the kind of the group of us that are fighting for things like life, are fighting such an asymmetric battle that we need these sorts of basic tools. And if we don't have access to them, it's, in my opinion, it's sort of hopeless. So even if there can be some evil that comes out of it, and inevitably there will be, which I struggle with, of course, what's at stake warrants this sort of extreme action. So I just hope that we can get the word out quickly enough that these sorts of technologies, the tech that we've built and the adjacent tech, are in the right hands early enough that sort of the right side collectively gets the advantage. I think that's the best we can do.
So that would be a wonderful place to end, but I'm going to ask you a couple more questions, one of which is completely trivial. And the trivial question is, since Bitcoin can be a bit scary for people, if somebody does want to use this for fundraising, do they have to use cryptocurrency, or can they use, if they're in a non-scary place, can they use some other form of funding?
Oh, of course, of course. The vast majority of organizations would not be using cryptocurrency. They'd be using, you know, they would be accepting credit card donations or bank transfer donations. The cryptocurrency element of this is sort of our contribution to the asymmetric side of a much smaller segment of the world, sort of that battle. But by and large, the organizations that use this technology are very much sort of like above ground, clean and squeaky organizations receiving credit card donations for, you know, a food bank or for a protest somewhere or something like that.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. And so if somebody's interested, and I really, really hope that basically everybody associated with any organization, you know, contacts you after this, how do they find out more? And what do they do now?
The best thing to do is go to HoudiniProject.org. So at HoudiniProject.org, you'll find all of the explanation of what the tech does. You'll find access directly to the code base. All of the code is available right on the website. And then you'll also have access to an open source chat platform where you can chat with us directly and anonymously to ask us questions or clarifications or to see if it's a good fit for you.
And my last question is, is there anything you've wanted to say that I've not given you the opportunity?
I've already sort of said it, but I'll reiterate it because you're giving me a platform. And that is that I feel like a lot of our brilliant minds in the world right now are squandered in places like Silicon Valley, lost in a narcissistic delusion, when the world is quite literally now burning. And if anyone out there is sort of in that boat or wavers and they're sort of like, you know, listening to what's going on in the world or vaguely aware of it, but they're not taking action, you know, the time to take action was yesterday. So it's time to drop what you're doing and run to the only battle that matters in the world. I would end it with that. Like, there is only one thing that matters, and that is the survival of life on this planet. And the window is so rapidly ticking down that to spend time on anything else is beyond narcissistic. It's purely destructive.
And no matter what your skills are, they're needed.
Absolutely. And I just say particularly techies because I think that that is a particularly sort of not valuable, but it is a world where people have gotten caught up in sort of the narcissism of the self-grandeur of it.
Well, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for being on the program, and I'd like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Roderick Campbell. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.